The idea that you should take charge, the idea that you should know yourself and know yourself really well and know what's inside of you and then lay out a course of action that follows from self-knowledge. This is kind of the key to the kingdom of modernity. And this is why gay people's coming out experience is so emblematic of modernity. It's probably why there are all those movies and storylines and TV shows and what have you that just keep coming back over and over again to the coming out experience as though it were new every time, right? And it's a story we like to tell and we keep telling, and it is the quintessence, if you will, of modernity. So I, you know, you might end up wanting to say something like modernity is very gay, and in a sense it is, but gays are also part of that modernity. You know, you could have the flip side of that as your argument as well.
Everyone, welcome back to BungaCast, the global politics podcast at the end of the end of history. I'm Alex Hochuli in São Paulo, Brazil. This podcast is also Philip Cunliffe in Canterbury. Hi, Phil.
Hi, how's it going?
George Hoare, who is away today. And we're delighted to welcome our guest today, Roger Lancaster, who regular listeners may recognize from episode 200, where we talked about, the world in one country, in which Roger put forward the case that Mexico and Mexico's experience over the 20th and early 21st centuries best expresses the global experience over the whole period. And I think argued that rather convincingly. Welcome back, Roger, I guess. Welcome back. Welcome back.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So for listeners who aren't familiar with Roger and his work, he's professor of anthropology and cultural studies at George Mason University, and he's the author of Life is Hard, Sex Panic and the Punitive State, and the book that we're here to talk about today, which has come out very recently, The Struggle to Be Gay in Mexico, for example. And I love that subtitle, and I want to use that more often. It's kind of wormed its way into my head in a particular tone, in Mexico, for example. I don't know if you say, is that how you say it in your own head?
Yes, that's it. It's funny how you come up with titles. And a former grad student of mine, Marcial Godoy, proposed it many years ago when this was in its infancy. And I couldn't come up with a better title. Well, actually, he had the title and I added the subtitle precisely because I think these are instances that are generalizable and not just located in Mexico.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you draw that out quite engagingly throughout the book. As I was saying to you before recording it, it's not structured in a kind of traditional fashion, I think. That makes it all the more interesting to read, the mixture of kind of some theorization mixed with the ethnographical work and everything. So I think that's, and particularly in relation to the question of Mexico and, for example, is those tying together those universal themes and elements which are maybe more specific to Mexico. Although I have to say, reading it from Brazil, a lot of things seem kind of similar and in other ways a bit different. So we can maybe get into that. So anyway, this is an episode about sexual politics. I think the last time we did this was back with Mark Simpson and River Page back in 2021. I'll include a link in the show notes if you want to check that out. So I guess we can, to a certain extent, this is a continuation of a discussion that we had then. So I wanted to start off as a way of kind of getting into the book, and I think one element of it. I remember I had a girlfriend once at the time who used to say that, oh, she thought all middle-class men were gay, which was just an expression of prejudice on her part. But it also, I guess, does reveal something that comes through in the book. And I think it's best exemplified in a chapter here where you open the chapter with a joke, the common joke in Mexico about putos. Well, maybe I'll let you recount it. I'm not going to
I told this joke so many times in different forums. I'm not sure I'm good at it anymore. But the shtick is basically this, right? So a young man comes to his father and says, "Father," and it's odd because it's his father, not his mother. Like the usual routine would be to tell one's mother, right? But he says, "Father, I have something to tell you." And yes, son, I'll listen to anything you have to say. I'm gay. And the father basically says, "Well, I didn't know that. Please know that I love you very much and whatever. But I have a few questions to ask you first." And then the father goes through a series of questions. Can you shop? Do you shop at high-end boutiques in the Zona Rosa? Do you live in a posh upscale part of town in a nice apartment? Can you even get into clubs that charge 100 pesos? That'd probably be 200 pesos by now. At the door. And the son basically says, "Well, no, father, you know, we can't afford things like that in this family." And the father says, "Well, son, remember that I love you very much, but you're confused. You're not gay. You're not gay. Eres solo un pinche puto. You're just a fucking fag." That's the best translation I can show, right? So this is a joke that people tell and retell over many years in Mexico. It hasn't lost much of its currency over that period of time. And what it tells us is that being gay is basically, that gayness is basically a middle class identity, that it's something accessible, available to people who have a certain amount of money in their pockets. And it also tells you that the boy in the joke is perpetually relegated to the role of an unhappy aspirant, someone reaching for but failing to attain the desired goods. And then, like, as a third angle, usually the people telling this joke are gay. Like, usually the people telling this joke are in the same situation. So it's auto-reflexive on their part. And Once I had heard this joke a couple of times, a lot of what I was seeing in field work started to make sense to me.
Yeah, no, and that comes through very, very clearly. I mean, the book is, I'm kind of loath to say it this way because of the connotations that term now has and all the kind of theory that's associated with it, but the intersection of class and sexuality. But intersection, you just go, well, are you saying that it's intersectional? And you're like, well, that would, I think, do a great disservice to a book, which is, it's fundamentally about class society. And I don't know if you want to maybe elaborate a little bit on, maybe through the means of one of your subjects or one of the people that you talk to and get to know over the course of the book in Mexico, as to how these things play out and all the sort of ambiguities and contradictions that they have to deal with.
Ambiguity and contradiction is a big part of the feel of the book, especially the second half, I think. So I follow the lives of working class men, many of them with rural backgrounds, some of them with indigenous backgrounds. I say some of them with indigenous backgrounds. A very large chunk of working class people in Mexico have indigenous backgrounds, if not their parents, then their grandparents. And if not their grandparents, then certainly their great grandparents. And I follow people's, one of the advantages of taking so long to do a book like this is that you can follow people's lives over several years. And I tried to do that with more than a handful of informants.
What it would be interesting to hear, if you could tell us the story of someone, maybe like Eric, I think. I'm going to ask you about Diego later on. But I
start with Eric, right? So Eric grew up in a poor family with 13 brothers and sisters. His parents spoke Nahuatl in their youths. They didn't teach, oddly enough, they didn't teach Nahuatl to their younger children. Only their older children had picked it up. And he's, you know, I sort of start the book with some reflections on his experiences as he's confronting, having his moment of truth, as it were, right? So to come out or to not come out. And it's made doubly or triply difficult by the fact that he grew up in a Jehovah's Witness church family. And I tried to show through his experience commonalities with the experiences of working class people coming out, not only in Mexico, but also in other places as well. His actual solution to the problem isn't exactly coming out, which is an interesting thing, right? In other words, at no point in the development does he ever stand up and say to his family or to other people in the community, I'm gay and I'm proud of it and I'm, you know, this is the way I am. Instead, he resorts to endurance. Endurance is the right term here, right? So Mexicans use the word aguantar a great deal. I don't know if it has a Portuguese equivalent.
It's the same, exactly. Yeah.
You endure it, you put up with it, you suffer it. Suffer is a big piece of it. You hang on, you hold out. And that's the kind of modality that he ends up with as a way of managing his life, his relationship, his experiences, and so on.
Could I just ask Roger, with did he have like did this informant, did he have like a kind of a mental frame of what coming out is supposed to be? In some kind of, you know, global vision of what coming out is? Or was there something, you know, something he aspired to that he was unable to do? Or did he kind of innovate it kind of purely from off his own resources, as it were?
So there, you prodded me along the right path with your question. Absolutely. Look, this is 2009, 2010. So, you know, the internet has happened. Internet cafes were everywhere while he was growing up. Pop music was taking up themes. Mexican telenovelas were taking up themes. By the time Eric, I have to think a second to remember what his pseudonym is, right? By the time Eric reaches his moment of truth, yes, he's fully informed by a global gay understanding, rainbow flags flapping and all of that, right? So yes, you would have a very hard time finding a subject in Mexico, even in a remote village, who isn't familiar with the whole scene in that way, right? But what I think I show and what I try to suss out in the lives of other people, not just Eric, but like, you know, a couple dozen other subjects that I cover, that's a tough one for working class people to latch onto, right? They don't get to sign on to that agenda. And part of the pathos, right? Therein lies the pathos. They know fully well what is expected of them, as it were. They know fully well what gayety is supposed to signify. Yeah. They know fully what they've all seen Will and Grace on TV by now, right? They've all had that other examples. And yet, either because of lack of resources or because of family pressures or because of a conservative zeitgeist in lower working class communities or because of a combination of these factors all coming together all at once, they often have very difficult, I want to say coming out experiences, but that's not altogether correct. They don't all come out. Some of them just endure. So Eric, before his drama was over, I think his father has broken into his room, discovered photos and love letters and journal entries and things like that, And so the father and two older brothers kidnap the boy and hold him hostage, as it were, for a week of beatings and scoldings and reclamations. And this then is how Eric ultimately deals with it. To my surprise, as these events unfold, he doesn't renounce his lover. He doesn't renounce his life. He just sort of survives a week of intense abuse. And I don't want to oversell the abuse. There was not, his family wasn't going to lynch him, right? I mean, this isn't like an extreme case, but he survives this week of family humiliation and torment and comes out the other side more cautious. Like it doesn't much change the way he lives his life. Keeps his boyfriend, keeps going to gay bars, keeps going to the gay scene. But like I observe that when he's out, you can often see him glancing around to make sure that no one from his community is around, to make sure that he's not being seen by the same gossips who had reported him to his father, right? And so on. So that, I think, gets you kind of deeply into the muck of what it's like, you know, from the first short chapter on.
And I mean, most of your work, I think, is done in Puebla, which is like an hour or something from Mexico City. And you note that it's, despite two hours, and despite it being quite a big city, it's quite a conservative sort of place, or has a kind of closeness to it, I guess.
Puebla has a reputation in Mexico. If you say Puebla, everybody automatically says, oh, conservative Puebla. And it's a colonial city with a glorious past. And it is very religious, even as Mexican cities go, supposedly. And the reputation is one of a families still have an awful lot of power over children and family members. So I would see it as kind of on the extreme side of a continuum, not incredibly different from other Mexican sites of its sort.
Just out of curiosity, on the point about, I mean, it's a small detail that might not be relevant, but I am it kind of, my curiosity is piqued. The people who spotted Eric initially, how did, you know, I mean, presumably they didn't out themselves by saying they were at a gay bar and they saw Eric there. So how was it reported back to his family?
He had been seen holding hands with his boyfriend in an area that was said to be frequented by gays, a part of town. See, this is the other side of Puebla, right? Puebla has these deep concerns, but it's also home of North America's Volkswagen plant, a big industrial hub. More places of higher learning per capita than any other city in Mexico. So there's this very odd hyper-modern clash of education nexus, industrial production on the German model, and Mexican family values kind of all in one place, which I think makes it an interesting place to do the research.
Well, it sounds like it almost as if this place exists in three different temporalities, right? It's like
exactly kind
of postmodern knowledge economy, the industrial, and the traditional. Right. I wanted to ask, there's a question which you, I think, phrase, or you suggest this in the book, that gay identity is ill-suited to the experience of poor and working class queers in Mexico and perhaps elsewhere. I wonder, you know, I think there's one reading of that, which is that, well, you know, contemporary gay identity is fine. And it's just the problem of people who have less means to access that. Or indeed, as you suggest elsewhere in the book, that, you know, there's a kind of a culture of poverty sort of argument that could be made there, that their aspirations are not, or their ability to meet their aspirations are not right, or maybe their aspirations are wrong. And that there's a misalignment there. So maybe you could talk us through how that misalignment plays out, and if you're, and what your criticisms may be of what the contemporary gay identity has become, perhaps.
Well, people aspire to all kinds of things that they can't quite ever fully realize. And that may be the condition of late modernity, I think. I end up wondering whether gayness is something that fits any of us terribly well, or whether we should think of it as an aspiration, as something in the future, something we aspire to, something we hope to get. Certainly look here. There's a tendency to, in the queer theory literature of the present, to presuppose that the analyst knows more than the analyzed about what is good for them. And Lauren Berlant's Cruel Optimism seems to me to be emblematic of this technique. In other words, Lauren Berlant lays out an argument where she sort of says, read as generously as possible, that it's when people aspire to the kinds of a good life that maybe existed during the high watermark of, you know, Fordist, welfare statist liberalism, they're caught in a kind of optimism that's cruel. It's cruel because it's not good for their flourishing. There's something wrong with it because it hurts them. And I actually try to disentangle myself from all of this, right? There's a kind of a critique in this that presupposes that the academic and the academic habitus has the perspective and can presumably instruct others on what's good for them, which is kind of it seems to me very problematic for anyone to say that I know what's good for you. So I try to wriggle myself free from that framework while still entertaining the problem of anguish and suffering in people's experience. On the one hand, Berlant seems to me to misdiagnose where the cruelty lies. The cruelty isn't in people's desire for something or another. The cruelty is in, you know, ruling class machinations that snatched away all of those conditions and left the working class in an increasingly precarious position. And on the other hand, you know, I don't know, what have you ever known that's better than struggle? I mean, life is a struggle. Everyone struggles. Let's start from there. Let's try to start from inside the experiences of people who struggle. And they struggle with the materials that are given them, not with those that we might wish for them to have. And let's start inside of those things and then try to work our way out with them to some kind of a solution. I'm not sure if that answers your question.
That's perfect. I'm glad you got onto to Berlant, because that's where I was, I guess, pointing towards. To build on that, I mean, when we last discussed sexuality like 3 years ago on this podcast, it's not a kind of very frequent topic for us.
I think this is the episode where the Bunga cast goes gay.
That was not it. Yeah.
Not just queer, which could mean almost anything, but gay. Okay. I'm sorry.
So what our guest Mark Simpson, you know, pointed out, made the argument that I think he thought a lot of gays in the late 70s and certainly in the early 80s were Thatcherites, because that's what it presented, a vision of modernity and of liberation, which ran against the kind of stodginess and closeness and social conservatism, small c social conservatism, of the 1970s and of, you know, working men's clubs and trade unions and all the rest of that. And So you can, I don't know what your thoughts on that are, or indeed from your own experience in the US, whether they were all Reaganites, but no.
A few might have been, but not many.
He was, from what I understood him to be saying, he was making kind of a cultural argument more than, it wasn't necessarily that they were politically kind of supportive of Thatcher, but kind of they were part of that moment of looking for kind of the idea of looking for individual kind of solutions to problems, to inherited kind of collective problems. And in this case, it was the kind of the inherited conservatism of social democratic Britain of the 1970s. And so they were, you know, whatever, they kind of, despite themselves, irrespective of their politics, that was what they were, the crust they were kind of trying to break through. And that was what she kind of appealed to.
Right.
So, I suppose to kind of set up the generous kind of point for the argument.
And I think the argument is, and I think it comes through in your book, the suggestion that to a certain extent, there's an idea of modernity, particularly in terms of subjectivity, in terms of being modern, which is very closely tied to gayness and vice versa. And that necessarily is a kind of a pretty consumerist vision of what it is to be modern, to be able to buy into that life, as the joke, which we started off this episode with, testifies to.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the British listeners will think Anthony Giddens, and they'll understand a lot of where this is coming from. I think my perspective on this was shaped by teaching globalization and to undergraduates, and Anthony Giddens was a kind of an important thinker along those lines, and he lays out a certain argument about globalization as modernity, as the unfolding of a new chapter in modernity. And it seems to me that that's more useful than a lot of the queer theory perspectives on this that I've encountered. The idea that you should take charge, the idea that you should know yourself and know yourself really well and know what's inside of you, and then lay out a course of action that follows from self-knowledge. This is kind of the key to the kingdom of modernity. And this is why gay people's coming out experience is so emblematic of modernity. It's probably why there are all those movies and storylines and TV shows and what have you that just keep coming back over and over again to the coming out experience as though it were new every time, right? And it's a story we like to tell and we keep telling, and it is the quintessence, if you will, of modernity. So you might end up wanting to say something like modernity is very gay, and in a sense it is, but gays are also part of that modernity. You could have the flip side of that as your argument as well. And so, I go off on a long series of reflections and meditations on the way modernity has unfolded in Mexican society and history over, more than 100 years, and what all of that means. Now, it is interesting that you start with that moment of neoliberal reaction in the UK and in the US. And there are some resonances there, right? Like, the moment where you can go through a lot of stages and nuances and developments, but sort of the high water mark for gay identity and gay subculture and the flourishing of a gay scene in Mexico would have been the 6-year period of Vicente Fox from 2000 to 2006. And it was a period of absolute neoliberal, I'm thinking of words in Spanish, like exprimir, wringing out of the working class every last ounce of value that could be extracted from the working class, precaritization everywhere. The economic scene was horrifying and ghastly, and even relatively conservative Mexican observers looked at the empty storefronts everywhere because everything was going under and said, this would be a good time for some, you know, for some social spending to kick in, because even the most conservative Mexicans understand, you know, social spending during times of crisis. But the government did not do that. It kept a very tight bottom line. So you had this, you had that on the economic front, but on the social front, you had the culmination of decades of new media and media, and you had the first generation coming out in an environment where the state is not trying to suppress gay scenes. You get the flourishing of gay nightlife, even in cities like Puebla, where gay nightlife had been kept historically under very close watch. I'm not to say it didn't exist, but it was not very visible.
So why was the Vicente Fox government, why was it so relaxed about this?
All right. So I try to cover this in the book. I do it better in the book than what I'll do here. But so 2000 was the culmination of democratizing trends in a neoliberalizing Mexico. So you had, you know, you had, let's go back to 1982 with the financial crisis that wiped out the economy for the next decade, right? You had starting after 1982, you had more and more neoliberal reforms in Mexico. By 1988, the public was fed up with it and voted to elect Cárdenas, not Lázaro, his son, Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas, president. The computer went dead as the results were coming in. And all the news reported the computer has crashed. And then the next day when the computer went back up, it showed not Cárdenas winning, but Salinas winning. And in this manner, the center-left dictatorship, let's be clear, because it was a center-left dictatorship, not mm-hmm. a center-right one. But it was a neoliberalizing center-left dictatorship by this time, right? And that was very different. But they stole the election in plain sight. It was outrageous. Everybody knew what happened. Everybody knew what happened on that night, right? So there you had a purloined election. Then you had another election conducted under questionable circumstances with lots of assassinations. In 1994, and then in 2000, Vicente Fox is elected president in a heavily contested race.
And Mexico's been beaten down over the past, I guess, when he's elected, two decades almost. You know, 18 years certainly since the big debt crisis in 82, and then the further financial crisis in early
in 94.
90, yeah.
So Mexico, the working class has been taking it on the chin since 1982. I mean, the 1980s were the lost decade in Mexico, as in most of Latin America. And by the time people were climbing out of that, then came the so-called tequila crisis in 1994. Which may have been triggered largely by the facts of the election and things are like the weird flows of money that were happening as the PRI sought to maintain power again in 94. So that one was another several years of intense suffering for working class people. And then The outshoot is that the Pri apparently will hand over power to a conservative, but not to a radical. Right? They would not hand over power to Cárdenas. I think it's safe to say a social democrat at the very least. His father was a socialist. But they would hand it over to PAN, the conservative party, and they did. And so you had a relatively weak presidency. How Vicente Fox campaigned was interesting, right? Like, I mean, he consistently referred to La Bastida as La Vestida. In other words, he called his opponent a drag queen. And most Mexican observers on the cultural left were, oh my God, so now we've got a Catholic conservative in the presidency. This has got to be bad news, right? This is terrible. And it was terrible in some ways. Like he put priests in charge of sex education, for example, and the state's staffing of medical offices that might have to do with contraception were also kind of screwy during these years. A former student of mine reports being present at a closed door presentation of initial data from the census surveys. And it turned out that under Fox's first 2 or 3 years, there had been a boom of 50,000 unanticipated births in remote villages. and the room was like, oh my God, this was not what we wanted to happen, right? So you've got a large chunk of unanticipated births happening in remote indigenous villages. And that probably had everything to do with birth control policy. So in some ways, Fox is just your standard issue conservative. I mean, and a gregarious man, a rancher, a Coca-Cola factory owner, and all of that. However, this is interesting, right? So he campaigned on a promise to leave civil society alone. Hands off civil society. So now the Pri had always kept its fingers on developments in civil society and would intervene to fuck it up if things got out of hand, right? So Fox campaigned on a promise to respect civil society, and he did. So there were no more campaigns to shut down gay organizations. There were no more campaigns to make it hard to get a liquor license if you're a gay establishment. There were no more campaigns. And then after a couple of years, he got really hip about it, right? So then after a couple of years, Fox lays the groundwork for incorporating NGOs into various kinds of state activities. So there was a new law passed that recognized the role of NGOs in development and anti-poverty and healthcare and so on. So by the end of the term, another year or so later, there's CONAPRED, and I can't remember what it stands for, but it's basically the Mexican Institute Against Discrimination, and it's a government office that. That is there to see to it that gays, lesbians, indigenous people, handicapped people, et cetera,
don't fairly face. Standard neoliberal anti-discrimination.
Yeah, I was going to say, a very typical kind of neoliberal maneuver.
Hey man, a raging cultural conservative, but within 2 or 3 years, he's moved his way over toward a kind of, cultural left neoliberal orientation. And it has long-standing consequences. But there's the environment. Now most people on the scene weren't plugged into NGOs, or they weren't plugged into this or that. But most people on the scene were able to see, oh my God, you know, here I am in Puebla. Let's say I'm 18, I'm coming out. And there are five gay establishments all within like one block, all on one section of one block, right? And whereas the official apparatus before would never have allowed that to happen, you have the flourishing of a gay scene. You see college kids walking, holding hands on the street for the first time in a stodgy conservative city like Puebla. And, you know, the cranberry colored hair senior ladies will walk by and their necks don't do whiplash. Look, you know, they too have come to accommodate some of this sea change, right? So there you have, I mean, there you have one of the nodal points of the book, which has to do with this intensely neoliberal period, a period of intense class oppression and suffering, but also it was a cultural opening. It was a democratic opening, and it was also a cultural opening.
Could you just briefly tell us what other kind of social and cultural liberalization happened in Mexico, if any, at the same time alongside this, to kind of so that we and our listeners kind of get a better sense of the whole package, as it were?
Sure. Well, look, I mean, you have to remember how closed Mexican society was under the PRI. You know, Mario Vargas Llosa came to Mexico, I forget, it was sometime in the 90s. It was late. And he's on this panel with Mexican intellectuals and international intellectuals. And he says, you know, they're talking, I remember, yes, it was the fall of the Soviet Union. And they're having a roundtable on the fall of the Soviet Union. And the Mexican house intellectuals are there, like, you know, Octavio Paz and Carlos Fuentes and their students and retinue. And Mario Vargas Llosa says, yes, but like in all of this, like, this isn't the fall of dictatorship. I mean, here in Mexico, you have the perfect dictatorship. You have a dictatorship that stays in power no matter what. And it suborns its intellectuals rather than executes them. But all right. So this went out live on the air, like this was Televisa, I think, or maybe TV Azteca. But it went out live, so there was no shutting it off in the middle of this conversation. The government sort of responded, like the government responded said something like, better to suborn the intellectuals by bribing them than to shoot them in the head and get rid of them, right? Which is, like, I think we all can see that that's probably true, although they did shoot some people in the head as well, right? But the next day, I mean, this was the end of this conversation happened. And the very next morning, Vargas Llosa is on an airplane headed back for Peru, right?
Yeah.
Like, you don't stay. Apparently, you didn't stay in the country after that. And I suppose his welcome was worn out. But so you had two TV stations, two TV channels, and one was government and the other one was government friendly. So you had a very controlled media environment. All right, this starts to loosen up in the 90s. This loosens up considerably in the 90s. As the 90s go on, you know, everybody's got those TV antennas on their rooftops. So they are getting access to international programming, whether you like it or not anyway, right? Pilfered codes gives you access to the world. And then internet cafes are everywhere. So people are on the World Wide Web. So that's the beginning of real changes, and it's reflected in Mexican popular music, popular culture, films, TV shows, all kind of convey those changes. By 2000, you really have kind of the by 2000, with the election of Fox, you have that already in full development. But so, for example, I mean, you've asked for other. I'm not sure. I think that much about the needs and lives of straight people. That's on me. That's not on you. So, but if you're asking, so cops would historically intervene in Puebla and most Mexican cities if they thought gay men were cruising in public places.
Yep.
But that stops by sometime around 2000. That largely stops, and that becomes a different, very different kind of thing.
I mean, you say in the book somewhere that progressive neoliberalism, which I think is Nancy Fraser's phrase, but I mean, I think everybody's not familiar with that notion, I think, broadly speaking. And you note that Mexico was probably ahead of the United States in kind of introducing that turn.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's my argument. Yes, Mexico. Like, if you look at all those things Vicente Fox did, and you look at how quickly, how early, relatively speaking, Mexico passed gay civil union, then gay marriage very quickly, well ahead of the U.S. Yeah, I think,
So why was it so, if you just had a kind of a very, why was it so far ahead? What would be the kind of the take-home point on being further ahead on that scale?
That's a good question. I'm not sure I have a good answer to it. I think part of it has to do with the feeling that you're overturning an establishment, the feeling that you're overturning the center-left dictatorship. And you can't really understand anything much in Mexico without understanding that the PRI was a very durable center-left dictatorship with socialist influences, socialist roots to some extent, and all socialist pretensions all the way through the worst years of the repression of student movement, new left radicals, and the counterculture.
Yeah. I mean, it's not just a party that was in like that ruled for a long time, but played a massive role in conceiving what the nation was. Right? I mean, it's pretty central in creating a notion of what to be Mexican was and to be modern in Mexico was, right?
Absolutely. I mean, some readers might think I'm being nostalgic for the PRI or something, and maybe a little bit. I mean, if at the end of the Mexican Revolution, the party state reinvented what it meant to be Mexican and made that available for the first time, conceivably, to everyone, right? So with the idea of mestizaje, the racial mixture, with the idea of that Mexican identity was a mestizo identity, mixed identity, with all of that, they start to lay out a modernist framework for a redistributive welfare state that includes the masses in it. I mean, the political classes had never included the masses before. They viewed the masses as an obstacle before, right? So yes, the pre-established, re-established Mexican nationhood, and also built a series of institutions that had a redistributive function, and for many people, more or less worked for a long period of time, more or less worked. Now, it wasn't a generous welfare state. It wasn't like, but it was moving in a certain direction, and up until 1982, one could still make an argument that you were working in a broadly progressive scenario.
So, I mean, one of the amazing kind of contradictions and tensions that comes through in the book in your discussion of gay politics, but it has such wider application. And it comes through in a phrase, which I think in some variations you repeat at several points, or maybe that some of your interviews are saying this, that the idea of having stable ground beneath your feet.
Right.
And this is experienced both in terms of those who have to leave their families because they come out and their families don't accept them, but also people who are maybe middle class and happily living a gay lifestyle, but maybe don't have the means to keep up with that lifestyle. And so that stable ground underneath your feet has different connotations or points in different directions about what might resolve or provide that sense of stability, both in terms of, you know, financial support or family support, or some sense of just being accepted by the world, has various different connotations, right? And I wanted to explore this sort of dialectic of liberation and exploitation that happens under neoliberalism, where I think we've already kind of touched on this, but the way that you lose something when the PRI loses power and the kind of Mexican kind of corporatism, dirigismo falls apart, and you move into the neoliberal period, you lose something. A lot of working class people lose and are more exploited as you go forward in time. And at the same time, there's this kind of cultural liberalization that comes in. And I don't know if you've found in your research whether your kind of subjects would testify to this in some way, or if you have some examples that of people kind of feeling torn between those I guess different visions of what Mexico is, and maybe not so much what it promised, but, you know, kind of the Mexico of the 70s versus the Mexico of the 2010s.
That's tricky. See, I would only get that when I talk to older people who have enough life experience to remember more than a generation or so, right? Most people coming onto the scene by the 90s or early 2000s are, of course, young people, and they aren't, I mean, the losses were all accomplished during their childhoods, right? So they do recount horrifying stories about what happened to them in the tequila crisis, right? So, you know.
Well, I mean, one of the ways I think this comes through as well, because there's this parallelism, I think, in the book. I don't know, between, you know, the PRI period and the neoliberal period,
right,
and the kind of mixed sort of gains and losses that you get, and also the move that some of the people who appear in your book describe in terms of leaving behind a family. So there's this kind of repressive security, like repression but security on one hand, or precarity and independence on the other. And it seems you know, this trade-off really informs a lot of the history that's recounted in this book, and as well as the present.
It's a trade-off, and it's true, and I hope I've done justice, you know, I hope I've done justice to it. I hope I've shown some of the things that precarity means to people. I mean, it's a nice abstract term, but like concretely, you know, I hope I've engaged that, right? Much more concretely. On the other hand, do people wax nostalgic for the old days of protected security, of repressive security? You put that well, right? Old people, maybe, like people my age, the informants that I have who are above 50, 60 might remember enough of that to express that. Younger informants don't remember anything other than the precarity of, I mean, they started out maybe in the precarity of the 90s. And now, of course, younger than that. I try to manage this. Whether I do it well or not is up to the reader, right? I try to manage this stuff by talking about, you know, I end up with a summary called The Gay Dialectic. And it's sort of like, you know, everyone who's lived under the history of capitalism has had both intense exploitation and intense taking, but also at the same time, these very same developments have opened up opportunities for self-realization, for redefining one's life, for taking this will sound awful, for taking some semblance of control over one's individual life, even though under impoverished terms, right? So there's the kind of a could you have had a fluorescence of gay life under the center-left dictatorship? I mean, I doubt it. I don't see where it would come from. I mean, maybe if you went all the way back to the 1920s and 30s, and if you had consolidated something there, maybe you could have had it. But instead, with the center left's nationalist project, with nation building, with its conception of the family and heterosexual roles and all of that as being integral to society, it's very difficult to see how you would have ever had that opening until you had, you know, the corrosion of all of that through neoliberalism. And we live these kinds of contradictions and ambiguity. We can't quite cast our vote on one side or the other because we're torn. That doesn't say what the future will be like, but there that's a different question.
Well, so I want to come on to the future in the latter part of this. Maybe now, though, if you could tell us about Diego, because the section on Diego, I thought, which I think is in the Putos chapter before, just before that, I think. Anyway, I found that story pretty interesting. He's a sort of working class, or even maybe sub-proletarian, as like the term that's used in Brazil. I don't know if that's used in Mexico, but I mean lower working class or lumpen proletarian, whatever. But that, and his aspirations, his desire for monogamous intimacy, but also being on the scene, lots of various kind of contradictory things there. I wonder if you could tell him and tell us about him, and then I have a very specific question about freedom.
Sure. All right. I'll try to tell you about Diego. I write better than I speaks. Oops, there's an example, but there. So Diego was a young man who had recently come from an indigenous village in Oaxaca. And he came to Puebla to study at the public university. And he was a clever lad. I mean, all of his, you know, his school teachers in the remote village, or in the village close to the remote village where he studied, had recognized his talents early on and had encouraged him to go to school. So there's all of that. And he even cleverly outwitted the admission system. I think he took an exam to study mathematics, and I mean he's playing the numbers basically, because very few people want to go to school to study mathematics. So he got in with a fellowship to study mathematics, even though he didn't seem to be remotely interested in math. But so he comes to the city, and I describe his life, which has been hooked up with, you know, he's been hooked up to the web since he was a teenager, and he's been savvy since he was in his mid to late teens. And he comes to the city as a young adult, and he loses his fellowship. He loses his position. He ends up washing dishes and cooking and helping out in a dive restaurant. And so all this while he's aspiring to a gay life. And it's, I mean, the obvious thing to say, and one of the early readers said it, I mean, I'm not, so the whole time, so he's focused on having an imaginary gay life, all the while his real life is falling apart under his feet, right? And he ends up homeless, and he's shuffling from one couch to another for a while. And that's of course, you know, that's true. But he, all right, the vignette that I start out with, which is probably the one you're fishing after with the question, right? So the vignette is somehow we're all watching Brokeback Mountain. I wanted to say Secrets of the Mountain. We're all watching Brokeback Mountain.
It's terrible translated movie titles. It's like, just play it straight. I mean, no pun intended, but like, don't stop being creative with the just translate it as it is. I never know what the titles are in Brazil versus like the American for American films and vice versa. So.
Yeah. So this is the scene though. I like, the people at the bar cafe that I hang out in have realized that I've never seen Brokeback Mountain and insist that we do it. And we assemble a viewing. And it's in my apartment, it's on my laptop, and we're all sitting around watching Brokeback Mountain. And the movie is like, I as the movie develops, I become emotional and I start to sniffle. And then by the ending scene, I start to cry. And so Diego, who's like all of 19 or something at this point, puts his arm around my shoulder and says, "Don't cry, Roger. You have to remember, they lived in a different time than us. We have the possibilities of being free. We have freedom now." Mm. And it's like, okay, so this is a very sweet gesture, right? This is a fascinating gesture. So, I mean, there's all kinds of things with time going on here, right? There's also all kinds of identifications going on. So I live in the same time as Diego. We cohabit this open field of possibilities today. They, and he means by they, he means just, you know, the cowboys in the Hollywood movie. And he means the they in his village, right, back in the mountains of Oaxaca. They live in a different time, right? And that's how he imagines the present. That's how he imagines the modern moment. And that's how he puts together a kind of vision of freedom and time and possibility and so on. Now, if I stop the story there, here's a kid who's, losing his home and been thrown out of his apartment, sleeping in the back of a dive cafe, which then goes under. So then he has no place to stay. He eventually beats a hasty retreat back to the village that he came from. And I think, at the time, I think, well, that's the end of the story. He's never coming. He's going to stay there. Like he'll go back and stay with his mother's family. And instead, he bided his time, saved up resources, came back to the city, started taking computer programming classes. And the early computer programming classes were kind of absurd. Like everybody knows how to use Microsoft Word, don't they? Like, I mean, you know, you start out somewhere though, but like they're, Excel spreadsheets and stuff like, and then he's like, he eventually finishes a degree, gets a job in management of all, like he's like an accountant basically. And like he ends up being the only informant I follow who got everything, well, most, he's the only one who has a story that culminates in some semblance of a middle-class ending.
Yeah.
It's like, it's possible. It does happen. Like it would be a false narrative if I wrote a story, if I wrote a book in which everyone's stories came to bad ends, right? Like, but so there's that.
Yeah. I mean, the line really stuck with me, and I noted down as soon as I read it, that his belief that the present is a time of freedom. And yeah. I don't know, maybe it's simple, and maybe I'm just being simple, but for me it was like, well, do people think that, right? I mean, yeah, I guess some people do live on that, maybe most people do, okay, but what is the nature of that? So it got me thinking, I mean, whether our time is a time of freedom, and what the political consequences of that are, because I as I got to think a little bit more about it, not just in relation to sexual liberation, but more sexual equality, but in a broader sense, even if it's just in terms of individual autonomy, let alone collective autonomy, that people assume, I think, that we live in a time of freedom, and that moments that where we're not free, right, where that freedom is impeded, is an injustice, right? It's like a breaking of the social contract that we were told we're free and we're not. And I wonder what would happen, you know, if we drop the assumption or the expectation that we actually live in a time of freedom, and that we, you know, I think that would be quite a big deal, because then we might have to claim freedom rather than argue against the injustice of those moments where we're denied a freedom which we expect ourselves to have. I don't know if
I think in this case, this was like the, you know, the apex of the liberation, the cultural liberation that was happening at the end of the Fox era, right? So you still have this illusion that you've really conquered something, that you've really made great strides forward, right? If only on the cultural and personal fronts, right? So I think that's what, I've heard other informants say that sense, right? They might be more sophisticated about where the freedom is and where it lies or how much of it you have and so on. But yeah, I agree. I mean, it would be, you know, another informant gave a very clever critique of a French existentialist book that I had recommended that he read as we had gone through the sales bins of used books on the street. And I had recommended the Little Prince. And he said, and a couple of weeks later, he gave me a very good book report back. And he said something like, well, I didn't really like that book. I mean, it seems to say that if you don't do exactly what you want to do, that you're wasting your life. But who can do what they want to do? Only rich people can do what they want to do. that's not a bad critique of that, right? So yeah, I don't know. I'm wrestling with your question. Because you have to say you're free to have enough action, right? But if you imagine that you're totally free, then what do you need to do, really? I mean, you already have everything.
Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely. We're going to maybe ponder that just for a second, because for listeners and indeed viewers, we're going to continue this discussion over at Patreon, patreon.com/bungacast, if you want to join us, the three of us, because we're going to continue talking a bit about Mexico, about the relationship between conservatism and revolution, and how they might be sometimes a little bit more closely associated than one might think. And we'll also maybe talk a little bit about Mexico's current president, AMLO, who will be leaving office soon, and there'll be elections in Mexico. So maybe just a little bit on that as well. So I hope you'll join us, but that's it for now. Thank you for watching. Bye-bye.